Welcome to Green Talk Radio. This is your host, Farron Dancer, on this beautiful spring day in Santa Fe. And Green Talk Radio is brought to you by Unicopia, a public benefit nonprofit organization dedicated to the awareness and knowledge that will help drive us toward a sustainable future. Today, here in the studio, I have my esteemed guest, New Mexico Public Regulation Commissioner Jason Marks. Welcome to the studio, Jason.
Thanks, Farron. I don't often get called esteemed, but I'm very happy to be your guest.
Well, and I look at you in that light, so maybe others do too, and they're just too shy to say it. I don't know. But Commissioner Marks, I just want to lead in a little bit. He has been a super proponent of environmental issues here in New Mexico. He's very much involved with our sustainable future that we like to talk about here on Green Talk Radio. And I consider him one of the champions in the political arena here in New Mexico. So I am honored to have you here today. Jason, can you just kind of lead in by telling us a little bit about your role at the PRC and a little bit of, as far as what's going on at this time and space here at the PRC?
Sure. You know, the PRC is one of those things that most people have heard about it, but they're not really sure what it does. And it's, you know, the Public Regulation Commission is basically our state's utility commission. We've got responsibility for setting rates for regulated utilities like PNM and other electric companies, gas companies. We do private water and sewer utilities. We also regulate commercial motor carriers and telephone companies. So one of the things I focused on in my 6 years on the commission has been making sure that consumers get a fair shake. And we just got out of this legislative session where I spent a lot of nights there trying to make sure that legislation that would deregulate Quest and some of the other phone companies prematurely did not pass. And I'm pleased to say that we're able to stop it before the end. And we also had some fair amount of environmental legislation in different areas. The area I'm most focused on, though, is the state's renewable portfolio standard for electricity, the requirement that utilities have a certain percentage of their electricity come from renewables, which dates back originally to 2002. My predecessors on the PRC did that through an administrative rule, the first RPS in New Mexico, and then it became a statute in 2004. And then in 2007, my colleague Ben Ray Lujan, who's now a congressman up here, and I helped lobby to extend the RPS, which had capped out at 10% for 2011. We've got it now to go to 15% by 2015 and 20% by 2020. There was at least three bills, maybe four, put into the legislature this year that would have scaled that back in different ways. And
they were able to fend that off.
They were able to fend those off. You know, Farron, when I first ran for the commission back in 2004, it was mainly good government trying to make sure that consumers got a fair shake. I used the slogan Consumer Watchdog. And
that was the slogan for the PRC?
Well, that was my slogan for my election. We're elected guys, and so I called myself the Consumer Watchdog. And it means, you know, I want to scrutinize what the utilities and regulated companies are doing real carefully and make sure the consumers get heard. And that was my main reason for running, my main platform. But I figured when I was running, people might ask me about the issues, and one of the big issues back in 2004 was this new renewable portfolio standard rule. And so I got myself educated on renewable energy some, and I was for it. And every, you know, it's like mom and apple pie. In the abstract, most people are for renewable energy, although that's starting to change. Maybe we can get to that later. But
yes, that is a discussion we need to have.
And so I learned something about wind power and solar power, got elected, and I learn more, and I started to hear about this thing called global warming and greenhouse gases, and started reading about it in some testimony at the PRC, started reading about it in the professional journals and hearing about it in conferences, and the more I learned, the more concerned I got. You introduced me as a big environmental champion. I guess what I'm trying to say is I didn't run for the PRC in 2004 as an environmentalist, but the more I learned about the risks and issues confronting us in energy policy, the more concerned I got and the more convinced I got that having a role in energy policy gave me an obligation to work towards a different kind of an energy infrastructure in this country, one that is economically sustainable and environmentally sustainable, because the risks, if we don't, are catastrophic. Again, you know, my first wife, she had Al Gore's book, Earth in the Balance, on the bookshelf, and I know the name of the book because I'd seen it there on the bookshelf. I'd never cracked it. I had no idea what it was about.
Huh.
And I didn't come to this with an axe to grind, but the facts convinced me. And the facts convinced me not only is there a big likelihood that if we don't change course, we're going to experience catastrophic climate change and global warming. And I can talk a little bit about what I see as the risks there. But
right.
it's a big risk. And even, you know, if there's some, like, you know, some small possibility that the skeptics are right, and I hope they are. Every time they come out with a new theory about sunspots, I look at it really carefully because I would really like them to be right. I'm scared about the likely alternative. But as long as there's a fairly high likelihood, any likelihood of this kind of catastrophe happening to us economically and environmentally, we need to mitigate that. It's just purely irresponsible to ignore the issue, even if you're not completely convinced that the scientific consensus is right. It's taking a huge gamble where the risks of losing will be devastating to our economy and to our kids' way of life, whereas the cost of mitigating climate change are real costs. But they're modest. They're things that
they're
we can afford.
They're modest cost in relationship to the potential catastrophic outcomes.
And, you know, as somebody who feels that one of the job of an elected leader is to weigh risks and manage risk for folks, I just can't understand why in our national conversation our leaders are not responding if they don't believe the science fully. Why aren't they at least responding to the risk and trying to mitigate the risk? A few years ago, we were hearing about what I call a no-risk strategy, which was to pursue climate change mitigation at a modest rate while we learn more, while we develop technologies. You know, you and I and others might disagree whether that was aggressive enough, mm-hmm. but the point there was...
It's less aggressive now, isn't
you know,
it?
things have gone backwards.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we had discussed a Wall Street Journal article that you had read recently. Do you want to just comment on what's sort of the tone nationally in terms of a political shift around renewable energies?
Yeah. In my 6 years doing this, Farron, what I've seen is on climate change and energy policy that until recently the arguments were pretty much economic. If you do... You know, if you do these subsidies, you're going to cost us money, or it's going to raise energy rates and cost jobs. And, you know, certainly the arguments are equally strong or stronger on the other side. In fact, the renewable energy industry is creating jobs. It creates economic development in a way that taking something out of the ground and that was put there millennia ago and burning it one time doesn't do. I mean, it's a much higher form of economic development to do renewable energy processes. But the arguments were economic
right.
until recently, and now they've really changed tone. What we saw, and this Wall Street Journal article I'm referring to, it's from a couple of days ago. And alerted me and I think the others to the fact that in the House Republican budget bill that passed out in February, the one they're arguing about right now and you know, 60 million of cuts, whatever, that included canceling the DOE's loan guarantee program for renewable energy projects. And what it would do is not it would cancel projects that have already been screened and approved and have commitments, and cancel the backstop federal loan guarantees for them. That's bad in several ways. Directly, we'll lose some good projects. We'll lose jobs. We'll lose some momentum towards sustainable energy supplies.
I scratch my head and wonder, and everybody does. Yeah. I mean, what is the motivation here? I mean, if it isn't economic, what is the motivation now? Is it political? Political?
I think sadly it is, and if you go back a few years ago, Republicans like our Senator Pete Domenici, Representative Heather Wilson, they weren't on board with mandates like a renewable portfolio standard, but they were on board with loan guarantees and tax policies to foster innovation in the United States on technologies like this.
And they also saw it as an economic benefit,
It was jobs. It was technological leadership. It was all these good things it was energy independence. A lot of positives, but today it's not there, and I think it's partisan politics. Renewable energy seems to have become the latest battleground in this culture war, where it seems like if Democrats, liberals are for something, the Republicans and especially some of their talk show hosts, probably on some other radio stations.
We can mention Rush Limbaugh.
Guys like Rush and Sean Hannity, because it really wasn't the elected leadership. Folks like John McCain, he was for climate legislation until a few years ago.
It became unpopular in his party, though, right?
And I think, though, it came from the folks who are not really looking at policy. They're not even looking at the economic interests of big oil or coal companies. They're just looking for wedge issues to identify with one party versus the other, and it's really unfortunate. You can see it on a whole bunch of different issues, but energy policy is one area where we can't afford to make it into partisan politics. And I'm not sure what the solution is, but treating it, not recognizing that the debate has shifted, would be a mistake. Folks on the renewable energy side are still talking about the economics and the jobs, and they're missing the point of where these attacks are coming from.
Wasn't even George Bush a proponent of certain legislations way back a number of years ago?
George W. Bush created a renewable energy requirement in the state of Texas when he was a governor, and now Texas is a leader in wind energy. Mm-hmm. They see it as economic development. They see it as energy independence. Certainly there are environmental benefits that they probably don't scream and shout about, but they're getting. When George Bush ran for president back in 2000, he had CO2 regulation as part of his platform. And, I think probably Dick Cheney convinced him sooner after the election that that was a mistake. But you really didn't see a big change climate change and that sort of thing didn't become a litmus test in that Republican Party until about 3 years or so. And if you look at polling data, you'll see that there were splits between Democrats and Republicans on what they thought about climate change, whether it was real and what to do about it. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't night and day like it is today.
And another thing that our listeners may not be aware of is that George W. has one of the most palatial off-grid residences anywhere for anybody. Yeah. I mean, he's got a moat around it. It's completely off-grid. It's renewable energy galore.
Solar panels.
Yeah. And so it's kind of a dichotomy when you look at that.
Well, it's a dichotomy, but I think it's a change over time. And the economics haven't changed. In fact, the economics for renewables, for solar PV, have gone way better in the past few years. It doesn't need nearly as much subsidy. The programs are working. The whole idea of subsidizing renewables with tax breaks and requiring them, creating a market through renewable portfolio standards, was to buy down the cost through economies of scale, through technology development, and we've seen it. Wind used to be a 30-cent a kilowatt hour technology. Today, It had gotten as cheap as about 4 cents. It's about a 6 cent technology today. Solar had been, as recently as maybe 3 years ago, was over 20 cents, 25 cents. Today it's 10 to 12 cents for solar PV. That's after the federal tax credits. But it's getting to the point where what used to be, what I used to think might be a fantasy for some folks, what they called grid parity, when your PV system would cost the same or less as your retail electricity from the utility, that looks like we might see that in not too many years because of the technological advances in the PV industry. So the programs are being successful. The costs are coming down, but the opposition is growing.
Well, and part of what the opposition presents is the subsidies that are being generated toward renewable energies. But you and I also know that energy in general has been subsidized in our culture for many, many decades. And so when you point to one as being a reason to pull back the support and subsidies when everything else is being subsidized, and we talked about nuclear, and we'll get into that one. But
well, that's a perfect example that this isn't a matter of principle, because the subsidies for nuclear are huge.
And you said there is no public funding for nuclear.
Even before the Japanese disaster, you couldn't build a nuclear plant in this country with private financing. The same original legislation that created the loan guarantee program for the solar projects that's being proposed to be killed by the House Republicans put aside something like $8 billion in loan guarantees for nuclear, so even more than for renewables. Those loan guarantees are untouched by the House legislation. So if it was a question of, we just don't believe in government getting involved in the market, let the market decide,
then there wouldn't be those other subsidies.
Yeah, but it's they're picking and choosing technologies, and as somebody who thinks we need to put some oomph behind solar because I think it has a real big role to play in our future, I'm not going to criticize folks for picking and choosing technologies. What I am going to criticize them for, though, is politicizing and a technology and trying to go after the proponents of renewable energy for what appears to be partisan reasons. And it's going to be very harmful for this country. We're poised to, to be a player in terms of technological leadership. We still haven't caught up to Spain on solar thermal, but with some of these projects that got the loan guarantees, we'd start closing that gap, and we'd be putting investments in the ground for electric plants that don't require fuel that will be very, very that we'll be very happy to have 20 years from now, that the ratepayers will be happy to have.
Well, and 20 years ago, we were at the leading edge of all of this in terms of the world community and being a leader in developing the technology.
And this time we need to continue our momentum, to build on our momentum instead of rolling back.
Well, and the momentum was going strong back in the day. Of course, we knew when Ronnie Reagan took office, his first act as president was taking Jimmy Carter's collectors off the White House. And that was kind of telling as to who helped get him in office. But and then everything went in reverse from about 1980 until recent years. And now we've been gaining momentum again, only to see this same kind of pushback come in the other direction. And you're right, we need to keep the momentum going, no doubt.
I'm telling a horror story, and it's based on a bill that has passed the House. We don't know what the Senate's going to do. We know the Democrats in the Senate are compromising on various things. It would be really nice if the president would exert some leadership and say, you know what, anything that rolls our energy policy backwards, I can't sign. I'm going to have to veto. We need this is too important an issue. I know in people's daily lives, taxes make a big difference. Our food safety make a big difference. But we're talking about something that could have catastrophic impact on our country and our kids in the next 20, 30 years, and it's already starting.
Okay, well, we'll be back right in just a moment here on Green Talk Radio with Jason Marks here in the studio.
Shall prosper. Oh, no, they can't. If you are the big tree,
Welcome back to Green Talk Radio. This is your host, Farron Dancer. Farron Dancer, that's me. I have a monthly column in the Green Fire Times. Green Fire Times is a great publication available on newsstands throughout northern New Mexico. And anything regarding the sustainable environment, the sustainable future, our food supply, our energy, green building, all those things are covered in Green Fire Times. So if you want to stay up to speed, pick one up. I'm here in the studio with my guest, PRC Commissioner Jason Marks. And Jason, before the break, we were getting into this discussion about the partisan politics on a national basis.
Yeah. And I think I was also, for probably the 15th time, talking about the potentially catastrophic outcomes that we could see if we don't deal with, if we don't get rational about our energy policy. And just real quickly to explain what I'm concerned about is I don't see climate change as like the environmental issues when I was growing up in the 80s, or I'm not that young, but when I was an adult in the 80s, and where there was a jobs versus a fish or an owl or something like that. If climate change isn't mitigated, I see economic
catastrophe.
Yeah. You know, we're already seeing sea level rise with ice sheet melt in the Arctic and Greenland. We could see 3 to 6 feet of sea level rise, and it would be a different cause, but the kind of destruction you're seeing in Japan, we could see in many of our coastal cities. We'll have the cost of having to mitigate against that, relocating, water damage. We'll see a lot of what we saw with Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. That's one thing we'll see. We'll see the devastation of agriculture. Rainfall patterns, climate patterns are changing. The crops that grow today in one area won't be able to grow in the future. Drought is going to be a lot more. Extreme weather is what's predicted. Mm-hmm. Droughts in some places and more flooding in other. We know that's not good for agriculture. Forestry.
You mentioned something about few degrees shift in the climate would affect how trees grow across the board, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on biology, but from what I know, trees are very closely adapted to their ecosystem and the climate. And you know, you see conifers in some places, and you see deciduous trees in others. And anybody who's ever gone hiking knows that as you increase in altitude, the trees change in bands.
Right.
Temperature increase by 5, 6, 7 degrees on average, which is what's projected for the end of the century. The trees that grow in one area or another, they're not going to be able to survive that. Sure, different trees could do it, but it takes hundreds, if not thousands, of years for trees to migrate. And so you can see forests dying. We're seeing it already here in New Mexico. Anybody who's been out in the forest in New Mexico has seen that the heat has stressed our trees and the bark beetle has killed wide swaths of them. You'd see that around the country.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much throughout the West.
So we're not just talking about the quality of life being diminished for our kids and grandkids. We're also talking about the economic opportunities. You know, clearly skiing is gone and things like that. And that's why ski areas are big proponents of trying to use more renewable energy and clean up greenhouse gases. Forestry, hunting, fishing, those kinds of things. But agriculture, which is a mainstay here in this country, the relocation of population, international relocation. The Department of Defense, you know, has reported that they expect climate change to be the cause of wars, repeated wars over the next century, as people relocate from areas that have been flooded out or where the food supplies have failed because of climate change. So we're talking some really bad consequences.
And interestingly, you mentioned the Department of Defense, and they're already making They're looking towards the future because they understand this phenomenon. And so we have the Department of Defense that is in agreement that this climate change is happening. We have our labs here in New Mexico. The experts agree. So the scientific community internationally agrees on this issue, obviously.
So it's purely irrational that we as a people coming together through our government aren't trying to deal with it. And irrational in the long-term sense, but in the short-term sense, it appears to be providing at least some people with some short-term political gains.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do we get past that? I think one thing is conversations like this where we point it out, and we need – the political system needs to create a cost for this imprudent gambling.
How could they go about that, though?
You see, the mainstream media, for the most part, understands climate science, and they don't debate it. 10 years ago, they got suckered into these debates. And today, if you read a story even in the Journal or Time magazine, they'll talk about this is the scientific consensus, and it's being proven out. But there's still no – they'll say some disagree – and we don't treat those people like extremists. I think they need to be marginalized. I think there's plenty of room for people in both parties. We've seen it in the past. There are there were many Republicans who understood the need for an energy policy that developed a variety of alternatives that didn't close off any doors and that followed science. I think we need to create room in the debate for those folks again, and we need to point out that the folks who are who have made climate and renewable energy into partisan issues are behaving, what I would say, immorally.
Immorally.
Yeah, I think it's a moral issue at this point.
And we had a past president, Richard Nixon, who had some moral issues. But this fellow, when you look back at his record, was a fairly strong pro-environmentalist in many ways, which is a head-scratcher when you think about it.
But. We created the – now we're back to my real childhood. We created the EPA, and environmental protection was widely popular.
And that was a Richard Nixon evolution, the Environmental Protection Agency.
The Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, those things passed with bipartisan majorities in Congress. People wanted to clean up the air, clean up the water. It's really in the last decade or two that environmental protection has become a partisan battleground. There are some philosophical differences, but in general, people do want a do want a clean environment. And
you don't have to be a Democrat or a liberal to want a clean environment.
But, the original conservationists, environmentalists, were Republicans. Teddy Roosevelt, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
so the question is, what happened?
My district, which is Albuquerque, it's an urban district, but because of the way it's districted, my district actually leans slightly Republican. And when I've been out campaigning, and the last time I did it heavily, of course, was for re-election 2008, I will tell you that my positions on renewable energy were popular with virtually all my constituents. Maybe one out of 20 had some problem with it. But Democrats and Republicans alike, and I spent a lot of time talking to Republicans. That's one of my campaign secrets.
the cat's out of the bag.
And they think it's a good idea. So it's not public opinion. It's certainly not the economics. I don't have all the solutions, but I hope by talking about it, we can draw some attention to the fact that we are heading off on the wrong track, and we have much better alternatives. Maybe we could talk about that.
Well, in the next segment, we'll go way positive and talk about some uplifting alternatives. In the meantime, however, this partisan politic thing, and I know you and I aren't going to come up with the answer to it, but I think people need to be aware of what's happened in our culture, and that it's almost like if – if the other side of the aisle thought of a solution to something, then they're going to be against it just because of who thought of it. Yeah. And it's not about what's best for the common good. And so when you say immoral, I think we have lost track of the common good. And there's all this finger pointing and backstabbing that goes on. And I've talked to the senator, Senator Bingaman. I've talked to people that have worked both sides of the aisle in Washington. And years gone by, there was more bipartisan approaches to things, and you could reach across the aisle and get some consensus and build a consensus for a popular cause. And that's becoming less and less the game there. It's just us versus them.
Yeah.
And we are all Americans, aren't we?
I think you said it really well, and it really isn't us versus them. When it comes to this stuff, we're all in this together. It's not nobody's going to escape the effects.
Well, and I'll take it another level. We're all citizens of the planet. So, you know, the us versus them thing, when you go, I'm an American and they're not. Okay. So at some point, we're going to have to see ourselves as a world citizenry and kind of come together and work together towards the common good and towards things that really make sense for the planet.
Yeah. You know, I think as Americans or as Democrats or Republicans, we might have different ideas of solutions, but the science doesn't change, and the impact, the physics doesn't change based on what you believe in your head. And it's just overwhelming to me that we're putting our head in the sand on this. And
we brought up the Environmental Protection Agency, and for all that's gone on with that organization over the years, they have done some good things for the environment, and they're currently in San Juan County, conducting public hearings around the coal-burning power plant. And for my listeners to know, 2 weeks from today, we're going to dedicate a show to what's going on in the Navajo Nation, the Four Corners, the coal-burning power plant, and the EPA, and what they're looking to do to clean things up. But what's your take from the Public Regulatory Commission as far as coal and where the future stands with that?
Well, coal-fired electricity is our one of our biggest sources of greenhouse gas emissions. I can't remember the statistics. I think 60% of our greenhouse gases in the country come from the electric sector, and of that, three quarters are from coal. Somebody can check me on the internet at home, but we have to stop burning coal to produce electricity. Certainly burning coal in the current way. There's some people who believe that coal, clean coal with carbon capture and sequestration is a potential answer. I think the economics aren't looking that good for that. But one way or another, we do need to get out of the business of burning coal.
States are doing that.
We're seeing a movement there in Colorado. They have some new laws last year that are going to take out of service their oldest and dirtiest coal plants and replace them with natural gas fired generation. Something similar is happening in Oregon. They're taking the Umatilla Utility Commission out there approved taking the Umatilla coal plant out of service. They haven't said what they're going to replace it with formally, but they think it's going to be natural gas. And then in Arizona, just over the border from the San Juan Station, is one of the largest coal plants in the country, which is the Four Corners Station, run by APS. PNM is a minority owner there, and the situation's reversed at San Juan. What they're doing at the Four Corners Station is they're going to they have some of these same EPA regulatory squeeze going on with the traditional pollutants. They've got concern about CO2. What they're doing there is they're taking there's five units, I think. They're taking the two older ones out of service, and they're going to reduce their emissions in part that way.
By two-thirds?
They're taking two out of five, and they're smaller ones, but they're the dirtiest ones. And, you know, I think there are folks out there, myself included, who think we need a path to get coal out entirely over a few decades, but at least you're seeing some progress there. We're also seeing nationally, we're not seeing new coal plants actually get built. A lot of them have been stopped through permitting and finances, financial challenges. There have been one or two built, but it's way less than the number that were originally proposed.
Wasn't California going to offset some of that energy usage?
Yeah. In fact, what's going on with the APS Four Corners plant is Southern California Edison, which had been taking 800 megawatts from some of the newer units, is going to stop taking it because California has a law that says you can't import dirty electricity to California after a certain date. So they'll abandon that interest. APS will move their interest from the older plants to these newer ones, and they'll take some coal plants out of service. We're seeing that around the country. The other thing we're seeing, instead of building new coal plants or even nuclear plants, utility commissions are leaning and utilities are leaning towards natural gas. And I know there are some environmental concerns out there with how the shale gas is being developed with hydraulic fracking. But of the choices we have, it's the best bridge fuel we have. It produces half the CO2 for the same megawatt hours as coal.
Mm-hmm.
The capital investments are much more modest. It's not like a nuclear plant where the capital investments are huge. And
then it always goes twice the budget and twice as long to build and all
you know,
the rest.
Even before this Japanese disaster, the outlook for nuclear was not good. For economic reasons.
Right. It's never proven to be economically viable, I don't believe.
Well, certainly the new generation of large plants is. And we've got a company up here in Santa Fe, Hyperion, that says they've solved the problem with a smaller plant. You know, it remains to be seen if that's the answer. But natural gas is a lower risk choice. It's got some environmental benefits. And in fact, we've got natural gas plants today that only run at 50% or less capacity. And one thing that we could do if we wanted to reduce our CO2 emissions is change the dispatch order for existing plants and start running gas more and coal less. It wouldn't require any capital investments. With today's and the projected natural gas prices, the impact on electricity rates would be modest, and we'd be able to get a lot of CO2 out of the air.
So is there a big coal lobby that's keeping that from happening?
What's keeping it from happening is there's nothing to force it to happen. It will take putting a price on CO2 to make this happen. And
that's been a big debate here in the Roundhouse recently here in New Mexico.
And we could do that in New Mexico. It's a lot more practical to do it at a national level. But then we run into this debate you and I have been having, or we've been discussing. You and I haven't been debating. And we've got a path to the future. I can't sit here and say, it's going to be cost-free.
Right.
We will disturb some values. We'll have to run some transmission lines across the desert. We'll have to place some large solar plants out there that, all other things being equal, we might not want to do, but they're not equal. And we got a choice between doing those kinds of things and at the same time taking care of our greenhouse gas problem or not doing anything.
Right.
And there really is a path out there with increased deployment of renewables, the costs are coming down, backed up with natural gas, and you can take that to a point where we can achieve the goals that have been set out, like in Waxman-Markey, by 2050, with modest cost impacts to the consumer. In the last year, our price for gasoline has gone up 50%. We haven't seen any environmental benefits. We haven't seen any benefits for energy independence, energy security. In fact, the money is just going to those people who don't like us.
To the speculators and the investors.
And to the oil sheiks in the Middle East to sponsor terrorism, to ExxonMobil, which already makes more profits than they need. And we've 1 year 50%. If our electric rates went up by 40-50% over a couple of decades, we could absorb that, and we'd be doing that to make an investment in our future, to get off of this dependency on fossil fuels, to get off of this risk of environmental and economic catastrophe. It's the rational choice, and that's what we need to be doing.
Well, I want to thank my guest, Jason Marks. It's been a pleasure having you. We'll look for you next week here, 4 p.m. on Saturday, Green Talk Radio. This is Farron Dancer signing off.
Life is is one big road with lots of signs.